Can you hear me? Sounds like you can. Well, good evening, everybody. I'm delighted to be here with you and welcome you on this special event. I'm Rachel Bean. I'm the interim dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and the college is sponsoring this event tonight. Free press in a free society, US newsrooms on the front line, is part of the College of Arts and Sciences Distinguished Visiting Journalist Program, which brings accomplished journalists to Cornell each year to share their expertise to our campus community. Tonight's event is also co-sponsored by the university's Freedom of Expression initiative that's going on this year, and we're really grateful for their support. Our moderator tonight is NPR's media correspondent and alum, David Falkenflik, who is our 2023 Zubro Distinguished Visiting Journalist. David, as you all may know, graduated from the College of Arts and Sciences in the 1990s, I won't say exactly which one, with a degree in history. And he also served as the editor-in-chief for the Cornell Daily Sun, and I know he's had a great experience this week reconnecting with our current Daily Sun journalists. His stories and analyses are broadcast on multiple NPR programs, including All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and Here and Now. He previously served as the host of On Point, and he was named one of the 50 most influential people in American media by Business Insider. And we are truly thrilled to have him here as our DVJ this year. On our panel, I'm delighted to welcome, actually, David, do you want to come up at this time? On our panel, I'm delighted to welcome Sewell Chan, editor-in-chief of the Texas Tribune. He worked at numerous media outlets, including the New York Times, in multiple roles, and at the Washington Post. He also worked as deputy managing editor and then editorial page editor at the LA Times, where he oversaw coverage that was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in 2021. Please come up, Sewell. Thank you. Finally, it is my pleasure to introduce Suzanne Mettler, the John L. Senior Professor of American Institutions in the College of Arts and Sciences Department of Government. In her research, she is particularly interested in issues pertaining to democracy, both democratization and backsliding, inequality and citizenship. Her most recent book is Four Threats, The Recurring Crises of American Democracy. Please join us up here. So please join me in welcoming our three participants for this extremely timely and valuable discussion.
I want to make sure everyone can hear me out there, and thank you so much for coming to, I hope not squander, a lovely evening here on the Cornell campus. Appreciation for both Professor Melter and Sewell Chan for joining us today. Point of personal privilege, Cornell and Ithaca have been very important to me and my family, so I'm just delighted to be here. My parents met here as doctoral students in the early 1960s. My father meeting my mother at a meal with a bunch of graduate students downtown in Ithaca near the lake. Her then boyfriend wandered to go to the men's room, and he turned to her and said, "I'm going to marry you." She attested that this would not be the case, and about a year and a half later, they were engaged and got married. So it worked out well for me. My sister was born here in Ithaca before we moved for my father's first job, and I was born in Rochester. So it's a bit of a homecoming, and it's a lovely moment. So thank you all for joining us for this as well. This is an interesting moment for us in our society. We've got a talk today, or a conversation today is titled "The Free Press in a Free Society." It is at once more narrow and broader than even that. Suzanne, you think about these issues a lot. You know, the free press that we have in this country includes hundreds of newspapers bought by hedge funds and investors who have been called vulture capitalists. It includes a media baron who bestrides the Globe, who had to pay nearly $800 million to deal with the defamation he did about an election tech company, about the very workings of democracy during the last presidential election. We have had scoundrels tossed out of major jobs in media, left and right, it would seem, in cable news, in print, and other places for sins large and small. What is worth protecting about a free press? Why is it vital to the operation of a free society? Let's level set for a moment.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the freedom of the press is in our First Amendment, and so, you know, we've had it from the beginning, and it's been prized as being so important for citizens to be able to be informed about what government is doing, and to be able to be engaged and to participate. It's crucial to make representative government work. It's crucial for having accountability in government so that people know what government is doing, and then when they participate in elections, if they don't like what it's doing, they can, you know, vote the bums out and elect other people. So you really can't have democracy without freedom of the press and a healthy press.
And how free is the press that we have right now from your vantage point as somebody who studies the functioning of democracy?
Well, I would say it's quite free. It is, I mean, there's certainly been a lot of consolidation of the media, as you know, you mentioned, and like a lot of local television news, for example, being bought by Sinclair and those kinds of things. But compared to, you know, in some ways we had kind of a golden age of the media in the United States in the middle of the 20th century when we had lots and lots of newspapers, including local newspapers and regional newspapers, and also the three major networks that, you know, if you were going to watch television at 6 o'clock at night, you had to watch the news. You know, it was on all the channels and you had no other options. And then by the later 20th century, because of technology, you got this proliferation of cable news, and then eventually, you know, you're having the internet, and then in this century, social media. So there's lots and lots of alternatives, many more than there were at that point in time. But we've lost a lot of local newspapers, and a lot of regional newspapers are much smaller than they used to be, and their newsrooms are a lot more empty. So I would say, you know, it's free. We have freedom of the press, but that doesn't mean that all is well.
Sewell Chan, and folks may not know this, not only has he been at some of the most august newspapers of our land, not only does he head up this such an important not-for-profit newsroom in the state capital of Texas, and we can talk a bit about that in a moment, but also you're on the board of PEN America, which is a group about freedom of expression. You're on the board of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, if I'm not mistaken. You think about these issues globally and nationally as well as very locally. How true is that? To what degree are there threats or perils or inhibitions for the ability of the press to operate freely here?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you, David, and thank you all for coming out on a brisk and lovely evening. This is actually my first time in Ithaca. I'm embarrassed that it took this long because the campus is so beautiful. So thank you, and thank you, Dean Bean, for hosting me. And just a small correction, I'm a member of PEN America.
Forgive me.
But not on the board. That's okay. I think there's a lot of threats to the press right now. And I want to put that in perspective. You know, Mexico is one of the most dangerous places to be a journalist on Earth. And in fact, many of the places where journalists are killed are in democracies that are under threat in some way. Threats from repression, threats from organized crime, threats from sources that they cover. So by no means am I saying that the U.S. is quite at that level of danger as journalists in Mexico, Turkey, Brazil face, and certainly not in authoritarian systems like Russia and China. But there's a lot of threats to the press right now, and one I want to start highlight, because we'll get to the economic ones too, but I want to highlight the threat of misinformation. I fear that we're in a very fragmented information ecosystem where there are truly many Americans who are living, it's beyond silos and filter bubbles. They're truly in an alternative information system that is, you know, complete and comprehensive. It provides kind of a worldview. It provides a degree of coherence or even a sense of meaning and belonging. And it's very, very much at odds sometimes with fact-based journalism. And so, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in journalism, a lot of self-reflection on what we did. How have we contributed to the loss of trust? And what could we do to regain that trust? And I'm eager to talk about those themes.
Okay, can we unpack a little bit? You've talked about misinformation and social media, but also the ways in which the conventional media, and let's define them as what? News organizations doing original reporting and others that are sort of synthesizing them and presenting them to the public. Does this seem fair to assessment there? As opposed to platforms that are pushing out what people are creating themselves, the Metas, Facebook, Insta, Threads, Twitter, you know, TikTok, all the above. The threat of misinformation, from your standpoint, comes from where? Where is the original mover and sin in the misinformation that is harmful to what we're talking about?
It's a great question, and I think some of this stuff goes back decades. And Suzanne's work really looks at how American democracy got to this point. You certainly can't blame any one individual or any one factor. There are many. I would say the hyperpolarization of media, first of all, it's always existed, right? I mean, you know, nearly a century ago, Father Coughlin, you know, other, you know, kind of people used radio and then television to broadcast sometimes some pretty extreme viewpoints. But I think in its modern era, it starts kind of with talk radio in the 80s, and a lot of it, you know, kind of, you know, becomes quite political. I think the creation of the 24/7 news cycle, which was accelerated, I really point to 1996 as an interesting year because it's the year when Fox News started. It's also the year when MSNBC started. And I think part of the challenge of talking about about the press is the defining what is the press. You know, I never try to generalize because I know some good journalists at Fox News. They're actually focused on the news part. But when you ask most people who watch Fox News what they're focusing on, it's the commentary. And there is that blurring of news and opinion that I think is very, very dangerous. I've worked on both the news and opinion sides, and so I have a healthy respect for both sides. But I think opinion is kind of like the icing on the cake, but I'm mixing metaphors here, but the main course needs to be the news. It needs to be a fact-based foundation upon which we can then analyze, interpret, debate. When we don't have a shared basis of facts, we don't really have a foundation have meaningful discussions and debate.
A little footnote to that, though, even at your former, one of your thousands of former employers, the New York Times.
Just three.
You're right. No. Well, they're big ones, though. You got the Washington Post, the LA Times, the New York Times. It's some of the true pillars of American journalism, and that's part of why your perspective is so valued here. But if you look at the New York Times, which is extraordinary right now, I mean, it has 2,000 journalists. I didn't even realize this until earlier this year. 2,000 journalists built on this digital subscription base where they've just announced they have exceeded 10 million subscribers, which is unthought of until now, really just extraordinary. Per person, their opinion and editorial writers and figures bring in much more traffic than do the individual reporters on the news side. I mean, nobody can say the New York Times is failing to cover the news. They're throwing legions of bodies at the news, right? But it is clear that opinion on the digital space is helping really cement the economic salvation of the New York Times. Is that
opinion is an important factor. I was deputy op-ed editor of the New York Times for 4.5 years. And for sure, we were very proud of the popularity of the columnists and the popularity of the op-ed writers. I first met Suzanne more than a decade ago when I had the great honor and privilege of soliciting an essay from her and editing it for the Times. But I wouldn't say it's the only thing. Actually, to some extent, I don't want to go too much focused just on the Times, but the Times has actually got to that 10 million through a lot of things that are not traditional news. I mean, the Wordle acquisition. The recipes,
cooking
food,
wire
cooking food, their coverage of books, their general excellence is tremendous, their books coverage, their travel coverage. And of course, they've acquired Wirecutter, which is a product recommendation site, and then they recently acquired The Athletic and actually closed down their own standalone sports section. And so, you know, they've taken a lot of risks. So I want to give them a lot of credit for that because I think it's an indispensable organization. But I would say that the popularity comes in part because the Times is now almost part of a lifestyle, right? You can read advice about parenting and about food and about family. So opinion's a part of that, but I don't think the Times has a lot more opinion now. It also has a lot more news. So I wouldn't see them as the kind of a culprit. You know, I'm more concerned about, you know, p- people who mistake nonstop commentary for news. And to be honest, I don't think Fox is hardly the only culprit. You know, I think CNN went in a very opinion-heavy direction. MSNBC, I think, is more credible, but still it's very, very opinion-heavy. And if we look at why people like opinion, it's because it often affirms how we feel. And we're human, I'm human. It's sometimes fun or affirming to hear people articulate what it is you're thinking and to, you know, get angry at what you perceive to be the bad people and, you know, feel proud and rally for your team. When it's done at scale, I think that's the danger for our democracy. And that's why ultimately I think independent news is so important, because it's the foundation for critical thinking and critical debate.
Suzanne, go ahead.
Yeah, so I could weigh in here a little bit from what I've learned from my colleagues in political science who study the media and politics. And so there's this whole group of scholars who do very careful work, a lot of experiments and so on, and they're kind of produce very nuanced studies. And what they find would push back a little bit on the worries about echo chambers. So they find that, in fact, you know, most people don't pay that much attention to the news unless there's some major event going on where they'll pay a lot of attention. People who do pay a lot of attention to the news are very likely to consult several sources, so not just one. But the biggest concern is actually, in terms of echo chambers, is not what people get from the media, but what they get from their own social networks. And you know, this really builds on what we know about political partisanship, that when people are choosing, you know, which party they want to be part of, they don't do this careful, rational assessment of issues and say, you know, I need to think of what my values are and what where this party stands on all these particular issues. Rather, the most common thing that all of us do is we say, what do people like me do? People I know, my friends, my family, my network, what party do they have an affinity to? And then that's how we sort ourselves accordingly. And so people are influenced by, you know, to the extent there's some group of people who are watching some of these sites that will have a lot of misinformation. That's not that many people, but in their social network, it can have a wider reach. And so that is a concern. But I think it's the impact of media on people's attitudes about policy is not as great as we would think. But what is great, and I think you're maybe hinting at this, is what we call the impact on effective polarization, which is people's attitudes about the other party. It can lead to hostility toward the other party, animus toward the other party, this sense of us versus them. And that's really dangerous.
And just to drill down what you're saying there for a moment, it sounds like what you're saying that colleagues' research have reflected is that it's more about what you feel about the party that you find distasteful than about what you feel about the party that you may affiliate yourself with.
Yes, that's also true.
Like, there's a stronger negative association than there is a positive one to the other
side. We're voting against people now more than we are voting for, which is fascinating.
We call that negative partisanship, And, you know, if you think of it, for example, in 2016, when people were asked about their votes, there were more people who were saying, well, you know, I couldn't possibly vote for Hillary Clinton, or I couldn't possibly vote for Donald Trump, rather than saying, I really like the candidate I'm voting for. That's negative.
It did seem as though 2016 was the candidate of I couldn't possibly, you know, or excuse me, the race of I couldn't possibly more than any other I had experienced.
Well, the next one might be.
Well, you never know. Suzanne, it also seemed to me what you're describing in terms of, well, it's really about the people around you and, well, who are people like me going for? What are the people where I live going for, sort of thing? That sounds almost exactly like the algorithms that are being pushed at you on Instagram or whatever. People like you have wanted this this Reels. People like you have been interested in this story, right? Like, that's kind of what the whole idea is to push at you.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And you're thinking it's driving that.
Yeah. I mean, what's really such a big concern, I mean, partisan polarization has been growing in Congress since the 1980s, right? And when that began to grow, there was already some polarization growing in the United States among, you know, at the mass level among ordinary citizens that you know, grew on top of. But I would say in recent years, that has become exacerbated dramatically. So that we now have this sense of us versus them. that's very dangerous. And, you know, it's really interesting because in many cases, when you look at people's attitudes on issues, Democrats and Republicans aren't that far apart on lots of issues, but they can't stand each other, you know, and that's really dangerous.
It's about the uniforms.
Yes, yeah, and it can lead to, you know, just real hostility and willingness to have, you know, bad things happen to other people and so on.
All right, I want to come back to the national scene in a bit. I want to drill down on a local level and a different nature of us versus them. And I want to talk to you, Sewell, first about this, because I think there have been some very interesting moments of late. There was a candidate several years ago for the Congress who, when being questioned by an American reporter for The Guardian about his stance on healthcare, and I believe it was Medicaid expansion, but I can't quite remember, slammed him to the ground, breaking his glasses, and then denied that he did it, although it was on tape.
He's now governor of Montana.
More recently, you've seen a string of incidents in which local officials or authorities have really acted with not indifference of, not just mere avoidance of, but actual hostility toward the press. I want to talk about a couple of them, both of them in areas that you have some real knowledge. Let's talk first about Uvalde, mass shooting there at a school, deadly and tragic. But potentially not entirely unavoidable in terms of the deaths that occurred there. Reporters were trying to get information. Walk us through what happened there and how you interpret what it means in terms of the role the press plays in a community like that at a time like that.
Yeah, sure, thanks. You know, I'll never forget May 24th of 2022. It was actually a primary day for some statewide offices, so I began the day wondering if George P. Bush had a chance of being Attorney General of Texas. He did not. But of course, that afternoon, this unspeakable tragedy, the worst school shooting in Texas's history and the second deadliest shooting at an elementary, middle, or high school in American history after the Newtown, Connecticut shooting in 2012. It was a really good example of how, of some of the trends you describe, because if we think about the spectrum of official behavior toward the press, body slamming or persecuting or even imprisoning journalists is terrible. But there's a lot more that's more common, frankly, and I think just as pernicious. You know, in Uvalde, the government was quick to put out statements that did not end up really being borne out by fact. Now, I'm not saying they were intentional in trying to mislead, but there were a lot of times when the narrative shifted. And you see that after coverage of mass shootings or sometimes natural disasters, there's a real tension or balance, which I'm sympathetic to public officials that they have to tread. They're being asked to be as transparent as possible. But they also, of course, are trying to provide reliable information.
Because and the first reports are often just wrong.
And the first report. But, you know, in the case of Uvalde, you know, the governor went and said that, you know, everyone who, you know, there was a hero. And it got a lot more complicated than that. It turned out that law enforcement, you know, there were 300 law enforcement officers who responded. And it took, as is well known now, more than an hour before anyone was, you know, they were ready to breach the door. And frankly, there was a lot of finger pointing. You know, the state kind of said, basically said these local law enforcement people don't know what they're doing. But then meanwhile, there were state troopers there, and there were feds there, border patrol. There were like a significant number of DHS personnel. So, you know, to this day, I think, you know, we've got learned a lot more. We're working on a second film with Frontline that will come out in December that will reveal even more. But I think it's an example of in a fast-moving situation, you know, the government not being fully accurate and not being responsive. So we're part of a class action lawsuit represented, you know, by organizations like Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press to try to get full records. You know what? We asked for video, audio, body cam footage. The response until now is that is confidential information that cannot be disclosed because of a criminal investigation. But hold on. Authorities have said repeatedly that the one and only one person was responsible, the gunman, and obviously he's dead. So what is the active criminal investigation, given that there's pretty much no prospect of anyone being charged? The state court has agreed with us and actually issued a ruling ordering the Department of Public Safety to turn over the records. That ruling is now being appealed.
So look, this is a very upsetting, I mean, beyond upsetting event, and there are family members and survivors there for whom any information will be upsetting. Why is it important that you get the information? What is it that you hope to achieve? What's necessary about disclosure of stuff about even such a tragedy?
Well, I think part of it is bearing witness. I'm very, very sad that the mass shootings phenomenon has become kind of a routine. I actually had someone on my staff write an essay about the numbing familiar cycle: outrage, anger, the grief and the funerals, and then no policies getting changed. In this case, actually, some policies were changed. There was congressional action to encourage the so-called red flag laws and to increase the mental health investments. It was very modest, but it was really the first substantial gun legislation since the so-called assault weapons ban in 1994. So there was some government action. But look, it's really important to me because as journalists, we've developed a better understanding of trauma, the trauma that our sources experience and how we should not try to deepen that trauma, but also the trauma we sometimes experience by bearing witness. But focusing on the sources' trauma, you know, we have been adamant from the very beginning. We've never published the gunman's name in the headline. We've mentioned his name, but we've never focused on him. We've never made the lead art, his image, the lead art, because we actually do know that some media, there might be a copycat effect among disturbed, young people, young men usually. And in every case, we have a WhatsApp group with many of the families, and they trust us. So every time we've had a revelation or broken a big story, we've told them it's coming, so that they're not caught flat-footed and they're not kind of re-traumatized.
But not to put too fine a point on it, what you're trying to do is have accountability. What you're trying to do is say, listen, we're not just in the blame game exactly, but these are public figures given public office. They act under color of public authority. They have weapons and badges, and we, pay them and expect in difficult jobs, nonetheless, try to protect us as best they can. And our children, the most helpless among us, were not protected. And that they, hundreds of law enforcement officials gathered around this school, and nobody acted for over an hour because they were just sitting around trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah, and look, I'm sympathetic. Many of them were afraid of the fact that the gunman had an AR-15. They knew he had a military-grade semi-automatic weapon. But I'll also add to that just briefly, there's a lot of other dimensions beyond just the law enforcement response. The gunman in the Uvalde shooting bought the gun, he ordered it, I think, online the day he turned 18. He had never shot a gun before. Like, not even like hunting or, using a .22 to kill a squirrel or something. And he had a record of mental illness. Now, he hadn't been formally diagnosed. He had never been psychiatrically hospitalized, but he was so well known, unfortunately, among his peers and schoolmates as being disturbed that his nickname was school shooter. Now, of course, that's very, very tragic that that did not make its way to the authorities. And that's a huge question about youth mental health that's too big for this conversation.
Before we move on, there have been a number of other instances. There was a raid on in Kansas, on a small town newspaper's editors, not only offices, but homes, and a seizing of their materials by police officials from a department led by a chief who had been briefly investigated by the publication. There was a raid of editors in Alabama, I believe.
One was jailed, I believe.
One was jailed,
yeah.
Right, over disclosure of grand jury proceedings, investigation of school board officials and the like. There were instances in California, I believe, before you joined the Texas Tribune, when you were at the LA Times, involving police in the police officers at Echo Park at this huge protest, and also involving sheriff's deputies. In an instance where they essentially threw a reporter to the ground, crunched her iPhone, and then denied doing it. I think they just had to pay $700,000. Do you see anything thematic or different now?
Yeah.
And what do you see?
I think calling the press the enemy of the people, which the phrase enemy of the people, of course, originated with Lenin, that's not been helpful. And so, again, at the extreme end, you see arrests, violence, repression of a sort. And I think that's gonna become more common in America, sadly. And I do think about the safety of our journalists, their physical as well as emotional safety. But David, I also wanna point out to other norm violations that in a way are far more common, and because they're so common, very pernicious. there are elected officials, major elected officials now, who not only will ignore all requests from the press, but when they do get a request, they will sometimes screenshot it, post it on Twitter or X, and say, you know, this is an example of fake news. So not only not...
We've seen that, for example, for Ron DeSantis's communication staff in Florida.
Exactly. So really treating the press as an enemy rather than as, you know, representatives of readers, of voters. You know, we're not the sole representatives, nor do we claim to be, nor do we, in my view, nor should we try to police the boundaries of who counts as a journalist. But I think if you're in Florida, the Miami Herald's asking serious questions, at least making some effort to give them a response sounds very reasonable to me and in keeping with our democratic traditions. You also have, you see this all the time now, David, someone will ask the administration, someone will ask a politician for a quote, and the response will inevitably include a specific denunciation of that person's outlet. So, you know, if you ask me a question hypothetically, I would say, you know, in response, you know, David Folkenflik's question is not only outrageous, but shows the low depths to which NPR will go. And that's the only statement. So you're kind of obliged to use it. Usually we do. And I think it's just silly and immature. But that's just another example of norm erosion. Rather than simply saying, well, we disagree with the premise. Or, you know, here's some context, David, that you should consider. We're actually talking to you as a human being and picking up the phone and trying to argue or at least explain their point of view. And I don't think it's too much to ask for that of our public officials.
Suzanne, you know, it's a big country out there. We got 330-some million people and a whole lot of news sites that are new as well as the ones that are managed to endure somehow. Maybe these are isolated cases. What's the harm with what you're hearing?
Well, actually, what I'm thinking as I'm listening is this is a familiar story in American history. So, you know, if you go back to the very beginning, you know, the 1790s, we had... polarization emerged in the United States very quickly, even among people who, you know, as they were drafting the Constitution, were very much against political parties. And then they start themselves leading the beginnings of political parties and creating newspapers, rival newspapers, that were their mouthpieces, were really partisan mouthpieces. And they are writing anonymous op-eds. So this is, you know, Hamilton speaking on behalf of the Federalists. And then you have both Jefferson and Madison speaking on behalf of the Democratic Republicans. And you know that they're really going after each other from the beginning. And by the by later in that decade, you have the Alien and Sedition Act signed into law by President John Adams. And there are journalists who had been critical of the government as led by the Federalists who were actually incarcerated. So, you know, while there was this ideal that I talked about earlier of freedom of the press from the beginning, right away there was suppression of the press, right? And then, you know, that law is terminated by, you know, a few years later. But each time, so we've had high levels of partisan polarization at several points in the United States, and each time it has presented a threat to democracy. And the way I see it is the media is... the medium, necessarily, it's conveying the news in the midst of that polarized environment, so it necessarily comes under attack by people who don't like the information that it's presenting. And so this happens in the 1850s, in the lead up to the Civil War. It happens again in the 1890s when you know, we have the, by the end of that decade, you have millions of African-American men who had been practicing their voting rights for a few decades lose those voting rights, and they lose them for 60 years. But we kind of forget about this because in the middle of the 20th century, there were much lower levels of polarization, and the media wasn't under attack in the same way.
So you very closely affiliate pressure on the media with rise of polarization.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, I think of, I may be mistaken, but my recollection is a former university president, Woodrow Wilson, when president of the United States, basically wanted people thrown in jail, or at least he allowed his Justice Department to throw people in jail for disagreeing with folks about World War I, right?
Yeah.
So it feels like an up and down thing. I want to go back to your question of the Golden Age and the question of polarization, because we think about the mid-century as kind of an enormous age. We've got ultimately what evolves into the three big newscasts, although let's be clear, it didn't become, I think, a 30-minute newscast until the early 60s. And I think they had been 15, and then they kind of built out, and NBC owned two of them, and ABC finally bought one of the NBC Blue brand, so it's all a little confusing. But you know, there was a time where you could call it polarization, but it was almost like newspapers were cable channels, right? So I did a story on Cleveland Plain Dealer and the way in which it evolved, and I looked at it, and I had taken some interest in the paper because I'd been in Cleveland for the 2016 Republican convention, and there was a signage up there that explained that Cleveland changed its name from Cleve with an A to the spelling it has now because the Plain Dealer spelled it the way it did, which it tells you something about the power of the press, I guess. But there were newspapers originally for not only like you know Whigs and Republicans, but also I think Lutherans and the labor movement and the business interests, and there was a there were different stripes of newspapers that were very different, and they became standardized over time, because as the newspapers dropped down, they needed to kind of broadcast rather than have more niche audiences. And once they did that, and you had these three big television stations or what have you, a lot of news was left out. I mean, we weren't speaking to women as full citizens. We sure weren't talking about African Americans or Latinos as full citizens, much less Asian Americans in California and elsewhere. You know, like this was a golden era that cast a light in certain ways, reflecting itself as part of the establishment, but not shedding that light on the great texture of America, right?
Well, it's a really interesting point. I mean, in the 19th century, there was very quickly this proliferation of newspapers in the United States. I mean, the numbers were striking, you know, and but a lot of it was partisan newspapers, you know. But then there was also the rise of black-owned newspapers by the late 19th century, really fascinating. And, you know, all these kind of specialty newspapers, as you're saying. So I can see that there's, you know, a loss there. On the other hand, in this period of, you know, the 1950s, 60s through the 80s, you have a lot of local newspapers, and they are covering local news in terms of, you know, going to the town boards and school board, et cetera, and reporting on those so that, you know, people know what's happening in their local area and also in state politics. And we don't have that now. I mean, things have become very nationalized as local newspapers went under and as more, you know, small city and regional newspapers have downsized, have smaller number of reporters in their newsrooms. So they just can't do all of that reporting on government. And so what has followed from this is lower participation in local elections and even less knowledge of, you know, who is the mayor of my town? You know, who is the supervisor of my town?
There are people now running on things where their legal, the job they're running for has absolutely no influence on the thing they're talking about. And it's, you know, but I've seen this in both parties. I mean, to be honest, you know, I got an Austin mayoral leaflet from a progressive candidate that talked about abortion, and very important issue, and her perspective is important. But I was like, you're running for mayor. That's really not, like, it's a state and federal. There's not really not a municipal role that's easy to play. So that's an interesting example.
No, it's a great point. And in fact, what, you know, local governments do is a lot of things that affect our daily lives, you know, like the trash collection, for example, and the sewage system and all kinds of other things. And yet, you're right, as we've seen the nationalization of politics.
Hard to get national donor money flooding into an Austin mayoral race with somebody calling for more logical recycling separation on Tuesdays.
Right. But you know, as Sewell says, then you have, you know, places like Wyoming, where the gubernatorial race is being driven by issues around immigration, where, you know, there's just not a lot of people who are immigrants coming to Wyoming. But there's a loss of emphasis on state and local issues.
Sewell, do you, to what degree do you think that the peril to the press posed by the lack of public embrace of it, or the public investment in it, you know, emotional stake in it, is driven by what Suzanne's talking about, by this retreat from the kind of everyday plus accountability journalism that really looks hard at what local agencies, officials, governments are doing with our tax dollars and in our name?
I'm going to answer that by staying on the subject of the mid-20th century, if you don't mind. I'm not a believer that it was a golden age for all the reasons, David, that you mentioned. You know, one of the things I did at the LA Times was write a formal apology for the institution's history of racist coverage. It was during 2020, and we looked at the coverage of the 1965 Watts uprising and the 1992 civil unrest in LA, and asked how we were, asked reflectively what we were covering in 2020. So there are many communities that were underserved. These newsrooms were largely white men, et cetera. But I also think sometimes that, especially some younger, more progressive journalists don't see what was good about that era. What was good about that era was a very strong sense of professional norms and ethics. This was the era that ultimately kind of reached its peak in Watergate. And people don't remember that Watergate ultimately was about the system working. I mean, there were terrible things that had gone on. But ultimately, the system worked in that there was some degree of accountability, which is sadly not really an expectation anymore. So, you know, what I also fear has been lost is, well, there was certainly a much bigger economic base for journalism. But it's also true, if we're being self-critical, that, you know, in 1960, if you were a newspaper, you had let's say in Cleveland, you had a monopoly on local advertising. You had downtowns that, yes, were being hollowed out a little bit by white flight and suburbanization. But you still had retailers where the best way to reach people was the newspaper. You also had people turn to the newspaper for weather, sports, crosswords, comics, advice columns, and all sorts of things that have kind of become all disaggregated and unbundled now. And so, you know, frankly, in 1960, just to choose a year, you know, you probably, or certainly by 1980, papers like the Miami Herald and the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Baltimore Sun, your former employer, had reporters based overseas. Now, the rap on some of it, in hindsight, was they were covering maybe, you know, the Middle East, but not necessarily covering low-income neighborhoods in their own communities. But there was a sense of responsibility that if you made profits, which were relatively easy back then, you would plow that back into expensive reporting, foreign reporting, Washington coverage, as it pertains to your state, and investigative reporting. And now we've reached a point where the economics are so bad that a lot of that reporting, which is among the highest value report, I don't think there's a lot of reporting that's low value, but if you look at like what's really important, investigative journalism really, really matters. Like having people who are local, not just from the national level, look at problems in communities, requesting records under freedom of information, sometimes suing to get those records, getting sources to talk. It's very time consuming, it's very expensive, and it's been harder and harder to finance and support that kind of journalism.
NPR earlier this year, you know, we laid off 10% of our staff. We're still at relatively very high levels of staffing, but that was a very hard blow for us.
Same
you guys, you guys went through that as well. We've seen that exceeded at the LA Times. Washington Post is basically hit hard as well. What bright spots or solutions are there? What have you learned about the creation? I mean, the Texas Tribune, even despite the layoffs, is one of these incredible innovations of recent years that I think people can look to and say, look, this is a place where the clickbait is about policy and substance, and it's fascinating and smart and not being done by a lot of folks there. But suddenly it is being done because you're partnering with some of the major other publications and outlets in the state to make sure it gets as broad an audience as possible. What do you take from that could help others in saying there are ways in which we can get our footing once more and we can recommit to this as a mission on a local level?
Yeah, so the MacArthur Foundation and some other funders have announced a $500 million plus investment in local news, which is much needed and it's terrific. And I think nonprofit news is a real bright spot, which is why these foundations are grabbing this opportunity to invest in it. However, it's also estimated by Boston Consulting Group that to make up for the loss of local news that has already happened would cost $1.5 to $1.7 billion per year. So obviously everyone's excited about this $500 million plus investment, but it just goes to show how much has been lost. You know, our model basically is that, you know, we don't have traditional ads, we have sponsorships, which are similar to ads, but we don't have a paywall. And I've worked at places that have a paywall. The paywall is what helped rebuild the New York Times. But for what we do, given that we got a lot of support from individuals, from foundations and endowments, And we really believe information for what we do should be free. So we don't have any, well, there's not even a registration wall. You don't, and thank you for the person applauding, because one of the things I really worry about is, as much as I love the Times and the Post, and I truly do, and the LA Times, when all the high quality information, you have to pull out a credit card to have access to it, but meanwhile the junk, the hoaxes, the conspiracy theories, the memes, and all that other crap is plentiful, free, and multiplying, should not be a surprise what the consequences to our democracy are. So I think nonprofit journalism is one bright spot. I think another is the kind of field of solutions journalism, which has at times been controversial. But solutions journalism really emphasizes looking at things that are working, whether it's a community group doing something at a very local level, whether it's young people or other activists highlighting an issue that needs to be better known. It's not so much good news, but it is about, instead of framing things as purely as conflict or negative or things are getting worse, and that framing is very common in news media, balancing it, not avoiding the critical, but balancing it with a little bit of a sense of what democratic agency we have as voters and as citizens. I happen to think that's very important, because if what we do in the press is just telling people how big the problems are, and they're huge, and how much worse it's getting, and they're getting worse, but if that's the only thing we're doing, it shouldn't surprise us that a lot of people are experiencing what scholars call news avoidance or news fatigue. You know, a lot of organizations lost audience after Biden took office. I don't think it's because, I mean, who knows? I don't think it's because people are like, oh, we love Biden, everything's fine. I think it's more that there wasn't the daily barrage from—
Holy cow, from, look at this.
From Trump, and that people are exhausted and remain somewhat exhausted. It's not some ringing endorsement of Biden, but I just think it's like that constant, you know, he was good for ratings, right? President of CBS News famously said, and it's
the chairman
it's
of CBS proper, CBS Corporation.
The chairman of CBS basically said Trump may be bad for America, but he's great for television news or whatever. And actually, I mean, he was telling the truth, but it's obviously our model should not be sustained on, you know, continuous outrage. I think if that's our business model, we're toast.
Susan, hop in here.
I'd love to chime in here. Yeah, so in the United States, I think that one of the largest problems we have in politics is that, whereas in the middle of the 20th century, majorities of Americans had pretty positive ideas about government, like that they could trust the federal government in Washington to do what was right some or all of the time, and on various different indicators like that of survey questions have been asked over long periods, people would respond very positively. And that has declined, you know, really since Watergate. And it's been very low. And I think, you know, we haven't talked yet about the question of, like, is there a bias among journalists? I think to the extent there's a bias that I think can be problematic, it's the professional bias. And I, you know, when you're talking about doing investigative journalism, that's a fabulous thing, and we certainly need that. And when government is doing something wrong, we need journalists to be, you know, finding out and letting the public know, absolutely. But not if that's done to the exclusion of also showing just how things work on a daily basis. And a lot of what government is doing is actually working pretty well, and yet we never learn about that. It might not seem like an exciting news story because it's more about the everyday of things. But, you know, if you take, for example, the Affordable Care Act, you know, when it was going through Congress, there was drama to it because there was real partisan division. And so there was a big question about, you know, is it going to pass or not? And so we heard that whole story. And then it nearly got killed several times. It's like a cat with nine lives. It, you know, the Supreme Court had a couple of opportunities to do it in, and it would, there were votes to repeal it in the House many times, and then finally, once Republicans had you know, both chambers and the White House, it looked like it was going to get repealed, and it came within one vote of being repealed, and it lived. What you don't, so all of those stories get covered because they're dramatic. What you don't hear about is all of the Americans who are now covered by it, because it has gradually, and particularly during the Biden administration, coverage has increased and increased and increased. And actually people's attitudes about it across party lines have improved, you know, from for Republicans from a very low point, but they've improved over time. And you don't hear about, you know, what it's doing for people. That's just one example. You know, what the agencies are doing.
The complaints is often characterized as you don't write stories when the planes land safely.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
You know, and what are you doing?
What the FAA is doing, what the EPA is doing, and so on. And all the way down to at the local level, stories that I would love to see get more attention is how local election administration works. With these people who are very serious about that and who, you know, are really trying to implement the rules when they run an election. And it takes a lot of volunteer effort and people who do this year in and year out. And we learn very little about that. So then people believe crazy things, that we have all kinds of fraud going on in American elections, which we don't, but because we know so little about it.
But I will push back just a little bit, because I actually agree with you, but I got to say, my colleagues at NPR actually cover that stuff. I've read stories like this in the Texas Tribune. I've read them in the Los Angeles Times. It's that they're not writing them consistently. I wonder, in terms of the dynamic you're describing, you know, we're seeing an incredible disconnect right now. I'm technically assigned to the business desk, and part of my job is covering the business of media, and it makes perfect sense in some ways and no sense in others, and it's all fine. But, you know, my colleagues talk about Wall Street, and they talk about the Fed, and they talk about, employment, levels, and they talk about union organizing and things like that. And they're talking about all these indices, and I'd say, right. But they're reporting time after time about, for example, inflation coming way down. They're reporting about unemployment staying at unbelievable record lows, even as inflation is coming back down. They're talking about how workers are organizing and getting better contracts, and suddenly their wages are being lifted, even as inflation is coming down. They're talking about how income differentials between, say, white and black Americans are narrowing. They're not the same, but they're distinctly, I think, went significantly narrowed in recent years. But people are convinced that the American economy is crashing and that their own experiences are terrible. I can't quite reconcile these things. Where do you locate that? Or Sewell, it sounds like you got some thoughts, but I'd be interested in each of you.
You know, there was actually an article in Politico today about a bunch of progressive organizations that met with President Biden, and they showed him internal polling that, you know, when they asked people how the economy doing, they were like, terrible, terrible, Biden's terrible for the economy. And then even when the questioner then said, well, headline inflation's down to 3.7, unemployment's at near historic lows, and, you know, wages are rising, GDP is rising, people still, their attitudes didn't change at all. And so I'm actually a little bit, I'd love to hear Suzanne's thoughts on why people believe that. I think part of it, in fairness, just looking at it as objectively as I can, things like food, fuel, and housing are still quite more expensive than they used to be. We also know that psychologically people, you know, notice when prices go up. They don't necessarily notice when their wages go up. And so I think there are some structural reasons. But I also agree that, unfortunately, we're at a time where people set in their opinions on all sorts of subjects very quickly and are not necessarily open to having their assumptions or presuppositions changed or influenced by the addition of more data. And I think it's that second larger, that latter larger problem that worries me the most.
I mean, I wonder in some ways if there's a question of, well, this is a Biden era and therefore there's the negative polarization you're talking about. If there's the idea that, you know, inflation was really high and the press ran not only inflation stories, but ran stories saying there will be a recession, and the recession never came, but it hit my industry brutally because people canceled ads in digital media and regular media, and that's why there are all these layoffs, particularly in podcasts, which had been a growth area, because people in the corporate world were anticipating a recession that never arrived, and the press, I think, played a role in that. But is it also perhaps that the press is apart from the people who are feeling the repercussions most keenly of the inflation, who live paycheck to paycheck, or who don't themselves have the padding that would allow them to sustain themselves more gently through some what seems like a more temporary inflation crunch than we might have feared at one point?
Well, let me just address that. You know, David, this is when I was talking about the mid-century norms. One of the things that I think was interesting is that at mid-century, you had a lot more journalists who grew up were working class. And journalism was then considered more of a craft than a profession. There were fewer journalism schools. The earliest journalism schools like Missouri and Columbia go back to the early 20th century. But really the professionalization of journalism in the late 20th century, you know, meant that this became a university-educated field with often more social status, whereas in the 1940s and 50s, even if all the people in mainstream newsrooms were white men, there was actually a lot more class diversity. And that's why I think we have to be nuanced here, because when I approach the diversity question in my newsroom, race, ethnicity, region, class, military service, religious knowledgeability, obviously I never would ask someone's faith or someone of my business, but there is a there are biases, but they're not the obvious ones. People who are very secular, journalism tends to be a very secular field. And so in the state of Texas, where I work at now, you know, getting people to at least understand, who really are familiar with the vocabulary of how, like, as evangelical voters frame things, and to cover them with a respectful, empathetic ability to listen, which doesn't mean that we're going to unproblematically cover or just recite what someone's saying, but it does mean at least being able to understand their worldview or how they got to that worldview. And I think that that shortage of empathy in journalism is in part because we're not as diverse a field as we need to be.
Can I just pause? We, in about 8, 10, 12 minutes, I want to start asking questions. We'll have people with microphones on either side. And if you go to those microphones, they'll line them up and I'll sort of point and we'll make sure it happens. We'll want to give initial preference to students if that's all right. But we got through about 45 minutes of this conversation, about 5, 6 minutes ago, before we heard the word Trump. So if we're going to talk about a free press and a free society without locating everything on him, and I think we did a pretty good job not doing that, I think we got to acknowledge the party represented by the elephant in the room, right? So let's talk about Donald Trump, Suzanne Mettler, for a moment, and about the press and about how, from your perch, it should think about addressing him as he is gearing up for this re-election bid. It seems almost insurmountable that he will not be the nominee. We have felt this before twice, but the media has struggled with this. I think it would be safe to say, Sewell. How should the media address him as a candidate and also his posture towards what we do as journalists in trying to inform the public?
I think, you know, it's very challenging. So so in studying the rise of contemporary polarization, in the story, as I understand it, I put a lot of focus on Newt Gingrich, who starts from the late 1970s to try to make the Republican Party a party that can win elections, and he wants it to be able to dominate in Congress, unlike being, you know, in the minority for decades. And he becomes a genius at working with the media, and he does two things that seem contradictory. One is that he is constantly lambasting the press, the liberal media, bashing the press. And, you know, up until that time, Republicans and Democrats alike trusted the media, and Republicans even a little bit more than the Democrats. And then conservatives, Republicans begin to have lower and lower views of the media going forward. But the other thing that Gingrich did was he knew how to get media attention. He knew how to create a spectacle and do things that made the Democrats look really embarrassed. And so he got a lot of media attention. Fast forward to Trump. I think Trump had both of those kinds of skills in working with the media, of, you know, bashing what he called fake news. And yet reporters, you know, would flock to him to talk with him and would cover him. So during the 2016 campaign, it was remarkable how much attention he got. And so there's a political scientist at Harvard Kennedy School, Tom Patterson, who studied all of this quantitatively and found that Trump got so much basically free advertising because, you know, he was a big news story that the press allowed him to be and covered him constantly. He was getting all of these headlines. And
more than $1 billion worth. Yeah.
Okay, extraordinary. And quite uncritically.
Yeah.
Like Hillary Clinton, because she was viewed as old news, was getting was being framed in ways that were very negative from the beginning. And so, you know, I think that's, again, a concern. I mean, now there's a lot of water over the dam, right, at this point in time. Trump is in some ways old news as well, and yet he is very talented at making himself the center of attention and getting a lot of free attention from the media.
Sure. I mean, let's be fair, and you and I touched on this when we spoke last week a little bit. You know, there were previous examples of this, you know,
Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew beat the heck out of the press, but knew how to command the press's attention. Certainly Joe McCarthy was expert at doing this, attacking the press as essentially Stalinists, but managing to have swarms of reporters up his press conferences.
George
like
Wallace, Huey Long.
George Wallace, Huey yep. Long, excellent examples, of the same sort of yep. thing. We know what it is that's happening and we cannot resist in the press, right? This is, I guess you would call it clickbait, except it's, it also is truly news. It is, that you have to think about how to formulate it. And look, lessons were derived from 2016. 2016, part of the problem from my perspective was not, the voters get to decide what they do, but cable channels would wait for hours for him to appear at an empty lectern on a huge platform with some American flag by it, while his Republican opponents were desperate to get any time at all, but they wanted to have the cameras fixed on Trump because at any moment he might appear, and when he did, at any moment he might say something that people couldn't believe was being said, and therefore they'd stick around. And that was a ratings-driven decision. I think there are different imperatives now, but we now know in ways that were not 100% evident, but were perhaps predictable in 2016, that he's willing to do things. What happened in November 2020 through January of 2021 suggests specific harms to the constitutional order. So as somebody who's interested in the study of the preservation of democracy, democratic institutions, I'm sure there are people who say, well, the press should be partisan. I don't think that's the role of major institutions like the Los Angeles Times or NPR or the Texas Tribune. You may disagree. I'm interested from your perch, not as a journalist, but as somebody who cares about these institutions, what should the press be doing, both in terms of such a figure who's been attacking the order, but who also attacks the legitimacy of the press itself?
So a distinction that I have learned to make is that between liberal versus conservative positions on public policy, which do not themselves present a danger to democracy. That's what democracy is supposed to be, is that we have a wide array of views that are expressed in public and are part of the political process so that people can be represented. But what's a problem is when we don't accept these basic rules of the game of how we're going to have this political competition. So having elections, free and fair elections, and respecting their outcomes is like number one. That's crucial. You don't have a democracy unless you have that. The rule of law, respecting the legitimacy of the political opposition. And that we're going to have different points of view, and that's okay. And we compete, have elections, somebody wins. And if you don't win, you can stand down and try to do better next time. But you have to let the side that won govern at that point. And then finally, the integrity of rights, so civil liberties, civil rights, voting rights, all of these things. So it's when those pillars of democracy are under threat that we really need to, that's dangerous. And so what I would like journalists to be doing is to be trying to educate the public on looking at those things, on those pillars of democracy. That's what we have to worry about. It's not people's policy positions, but it's really those basic pillars.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Sue.
Well, just responding to Suzanne, it's really interesting because we tend to be an organization that actually does take public policy very seriously, and we don't do that much rhetoric, and we don't cover national politics, and we've covered Trump rallies in Texas, but it's interesting what you say, because I agree that just these are hard calls that you make in real time. Just to take a really tangible example, we have a democracy reporter who covers, among other things, extremism and threats to democracy. And he pointed out on Twitter the other day, a comparison between something Hitler said in 1923, I think, and Trump's recent comments, in which he referred to the threat of people in America as vermin. Very, very dehumanizing language, of course. And at first I said to this reporter, well, was it necessary to point that out? And then I'm catching up with the news coverage, and it really was, even for Trump, a next level thing, right? There was an Israeli commander who said, we're dealing with human animals. And so, to my mind, all the things that you laid out, pluralism, respect for different points of view, respect for pluralism itself, that the notion that we are gonna be a pretty we're a very heterogeneous society, We're not very easy to govern, partly because we're a great experiment and all this pluralism and whether it can work. But I think contextualizing that is really, really important. And I'd also point out that a lot of the battles now are not, it's not as easy as just D versus R. In Texas, there's really a civil war within the Republican Party, and you still have an older faction that's become less numerous, that for shorthand, you could call them the kind of country club, low tax, pro-business types. These people are very, very proud of Texas's prosperity because a lot of jobs and people have moved to Texas. I think that's an important, good story. But these people are not that interested in the culture wars. Then you have the more Trumpist, you know, people who everything is about the book bans and LGBT and abortion, and they've been hugely successful. I'm not saying that those issues aren't important, but it's a real civil war within the party. And recently we had a story about the most influential super conservative PAC in the state. And we got a tip, so we staked it out, and we saw Nick Fuentes, who's an avowed white supremacist and anti-Semite, coming and going. Then we saw the chairman of the state GOP coming and going. And there have been a lot of repercussions. And to my surprise, positive surprise, there's been a lot of discussion, and people distance themselves. So there is a point at which people are willing to say that norm is too far to cross. I think we saw a little bit of that on January 6th. I don't think we saw enough. My personal view is that if the senators had taken the opportunity to push him out, I think they probably could have gotten there. But if you talk to McConnell's people off the record, they say it wasn't possible. But, you know, that was another missed opportunity.
Even in just recent hours, there have been a number of moments that have spoken to the question of, you know, respect for comity and respect for institutions. You had a congressman and a Democratic congressman and a Republican committee chairman in the House of Representatives who's committed to investigating Biden for all kinds of things, get into a shouting match, profane things said back and forth. A United States senator from, I believe, Oklahoma, Republican, offered to square up and fight a union leader who was testifying, who seemed to welcome the opportunity until Bernie Sanders.
Now, the union leader had attacked him on Twitter before the hearing.
They had a history before that, yes.
But what's so dramatic about that, the final line in the Washington Post story is Senator Bernie Sanders, who's chairing the committee, he can be heard, you know, the video captures the people talking over each other, and he says, stop this, sit down. And then finally, he said to Senator Mullen of Oklahoma, you're a United States senator.
Yeah, right. It was a reminder.
I thought that was
from today. Yeah. And meanwhile, Donald Trump, in that very story about vermin, you know, historians step forward to essentially say this is why this is dehumanizing and problematic in the way in which I think the professor is suggesting is useful to provide the context and not simply just relay it as these are statements being made. They then asked the campaign spokesman for Mr. Trump about the criticism from historians. And this is just reading verbatim. Stephen Chung, a Trump campaign spokesman, told the Post, those who try to make that ridiculous assertion are clearly snowflakes, grasping for anything because they are suffering from Trump derangement syndrome, and their entire existence will be crushed when President Trump returns to the White House. Close quote.
Their existence will be crushed, or their hopes and aspirations?
Their entire existence.
That's
so, you know, in some ways going to the question of, you know, is there legitimacy in somebody who criticizes you? Are you the honorable opposition as you'd be in Britain?
I don't want to focus on Trump too much, but he is sui generis in some important ways. But by the way, I absolutely believe he needs to be looked at in transnational context and historical context. But also, no president before Trump had ever been so sophisticated with, nor had as many interactions with, and even friendships with media. You have to remember that Donald Trump's first career, the real estate developer in New York in the 80s career, he's on the phone all the time with reporters. He does have a love-hate relationship, and right now it seems more like hate, but he and the media have a codependency. And I think like any codependency, there's pathologies on both sides. But this is part of the paradox of Trump when it comes to the press. He just recently had an off-the-record dinner in Mar-a-Lago with a bunch of high-profile journalists. I think there's an interesting ethical question of should we accept such an invitation or offer when we can go there. But I also, you know, look, Trump so likes attention. Princeton University Press publishes a book every 4 years in which historians attempt to do an initial assessment of a president's term right after they've left office. And so these historians, I think Julian Zelizer is one of them, they put together the book on Trump's term. For the first time ever, they were actually contacted. And this is Princeton University Press. This is not going to be a hugely read book. But Trump actually reached out to the scholars and said, I want to meet with you all. And they were like, we're scholars. We deal with documentary evidence. We're not ready to meet with you. But they met with him. And Trump was trying to defend his record. So yes, there's so much that's horrible, but there is also an element that is of codependency that I think makes it hard to unilaterally characterize his relationship with the press as the same as, say, Putin's.
All right, so that's a very strong comparison indeed. Let us start to take some questions. We'd love for you to sort of assemble up in the aisles, and we'll get some microphones to you. I'll try to direct traffic a little bit with Tricia and Linda here ably doing. You don't even have to just raise your hand. You can just go to the aisle, and they'll get you. Or you can, I guess, do it that way. Let's start with, this young lady here on the right, and then this gentleman in the Cornell sweatshirt in the middle. May not isolate him as the only one wearing a Cornell sweatshirt, but nonetheless.
Hello, thank you all for coming. I just have a quick question. So you, Professor Mettler, you talked about the rule of law and legitimacy of political opposition when speaking about democracy and democratic backsliding. So what should the press do when a major political party and its supporters no longer believe in the values of democracy? And what can we learn from other countries and the press there and their errors that they faced when they faced similar democratic backsliding?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. I think that it's really challenging for the press because, you know, what the press has done for the longest time is we treat both parties in equivalent ways, right? You try to talk about, you know, the Democratic Party has this position on an issue, the Republican Party has that position on an issue. And treating them both as, you know, fully legitimate parties that abide by, with the assumption, we don't even think about it, that they abide by these basic rules of the game. So then what do you do when one party, denies the outcome of an election, which is, you know, the most overt way that this has happened? I think that's really challenging, and that you just have to point that out clearly and, keep doing the coverage, keep making distinctions between members of that party who think that and those who don't. You know, you've got Mitt Romney, you've got Liz Cheney and so on who take a different approach. But I think you have to be very clear about it. But that's hard because I think a lot of the readership and viewership, and I mean, I'm sure this is the kind of thing you think about all the time, will then, you know, be thinking you're really biased. So I think it's a really fine line to walk.
Sewell, could you give us an example or two? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I kind of mean to put you on the spot of articles that you guys have done that have sort of been like, well, this isn't a partisan agenda, this isn't pro or con, but we're trying to throw this into relief here.
Yeah, and working and living in a red state, you know, partly I was drawn to this challenge because I'd spent my career in places like DC and New York, and it's really important, I think, for journalists to get out there. I agree with Suzanne. We have to draw important distinctions. There are some Republicans, even if they're a minority, who voted who voted in favor of certifying the election. There are some who voted for President Trump's impeachment and some who voted to convict him and remove him from office. As I said, in Texas, there are distinctions. There are some people who won't, you know, who do draw red lines, and there's a lot of intra-party contestation. But to get to your larger question, yeah, I think that it's a very valid critique, actually, of the media, of the so-called false equivalency, right? And really, in its, like, dumbest form, you know, it could be, this happened, though, back in the 80s, you know, you'd quote a climate scientist, then you'd quote a climate denier. Now, that really doesn't happen anymore because the science has been overwhelming. But I think, you know, part of the challenge for the press is that we're trying to do this in real time. And so the article today, for example, you know, maybe sometimes we need to be more explicit about, my gosh, this is such a violation of norms. It's also hard, though, because I think to some extent all of us are a little bit like the frogs in boiling water. And the water is getting hotter around us. And I actually think all of us are part of this in some ways, to the point where, and this is, by the way, part of the authoritarian playbook, to reduce the ability for us to be shocked and outraged, and because it's like we've become so numbed, regardless, yet, you know, and we're like, well, maybe this is the new normal. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think I think first of all, we in the press do have to be very, very careful and precise. And I think part of that is down to our use of language and always trying to not overly generalize, but try to actually look at what is the specific. We also in the press have to do a much better job of seeing where there are paradoxes and contradictions within any political party or platform. You know, it's never quite as simple. Just if I can just offer a really tangible example, the latest Times poll showing that Trump has nearly matched Biden among youth voters, 18 to 25, that 22% of black respondents said they plan to vote for Trump, which would be a high, if it happened, would be a higher proportion than any since like Eisenhower. The fact that a lot of Latinos, especially in places like Texas, are actually pretty many, not I'm not sure it's the most, but many are very conservative and hardline on immigration issues. So all I'm saying is not whether any group is right or wrong, but I'm just saying that there are nuances. And I think sometimes if we paint with too broad a brush, we're not doing enough careful listening. Like, why would a young black man say he's voting for Trump? I genuinely want to know. I'm not assuming he should vote for Biden. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that we have to actually look at and talk to people. And I think I have one fear, to be really frank, is that some journalists think that you can do everything by email, text, and phone, and there's really no replacement for driving somewhere. And I'm not saying go to a Midwestern diner, although I think the critique of the New York Times there is a little bit off. Yes, you should not only go to a diner, but I mean, I personally would go to a Walmart parking lot. But I think the critique is less than that they chose a diner than that they are flyby and that they're not there consistently. The Texas Tribune tries to be there consistently. But I'm sure there are many days we could do even better.
All right. Let's go to up here in the middle.
Thank you to all three of you for coming out, and thank you to Cornell for making this possible. Go Big Red. I had a question that I didn't get to ask you when you visited our classroom. A quote I've often heard is, "Truth is the first casualty of war," and I was reading your article about the newspapers.
Oh, this is what for me. Terrific.
Go ahead. It's for anyone.
Okay.
The New York Times citing Hamas and not doing the investigative research despite internal complaints. You write in the article, when the fog of war envelops the pursuit of breaking news, the journalism that follows often suffers. So as a concerned American who wants the truth and just wants to be informed about what's going on, where do I go? What can be done about this? And just any thoughts in general?
Sure, and I'll let the other panelists weigh in. I mean, what I would say is just, I would not rely on any one news source, however much you admire it. I would occasionally sample sources of news that are, find to be reputable that you may not always agree with if it has a point of view. But you know, if the Times of London and the New York Times and NPR and ABC are reporting something to be a case, and this sourcing is clear-cut and you know, something that you can rely upon, I would say that's pretty good. If things are very vague and it's fast-moving in the first couple hours, I think they're often doing the best they can, sometimes making mistakes of judgment in how they present it or craft it, or sometimes the information itself will not prove to be accurate. But you know, it's frustrating to say you're going to have to refresh. You're going to have to see what that story looks like in 4 hours, but that's kind of the way it works with instantaneous reporting. It's that it requires you to acknowledge that that's a snapshot of what they have at that time, because there's more and more pressure. Mark Lacey, who we had hoped to join us today, is a phenomenal Cornell graduate and journalist and managing editor of the New York Times, and helped lead their sort of, they don't call it this, but their instantaneous news coverage, which is that it just comes as quickly as they can, and they sort it and they report it because they want to have essentially what was a live blog giving you information in real time. But that means that information is going to be less precise than if they waited for the next day's paper, as they would have when Mark first came out of school, right? So it's a knowledge of the fallibility of this very mortal endeavor, which is tough, because the New York Times is also thinks of itself as the paper of record, and we all try to be authoritative in what we present. I will say, from having watched it from the inside, NPR just tends to be a little later, but also a little more careful than a lot of folks.
we are trying to present things with immediacy and urgency, but not instantaneously, because we want to make sure that what we're reporting is pinned down. But there are trade-offs. You know, they get there first often. Sometimes they have more bodies as well, more people to do this, but they will sometimes get a little deeper because they're because of the nature of what they are as a newsroom. But I would say, truly, don't rely on only one source. If you think something terrible has happened, find a couple of articles about it. I'm sorry, it really is putting the onus on us as citizens. You know, the whole point of what we do at NPR, what you do at the Texas Tribune, you know, we want to make more money than we spend so that we're in business. But we're there to fulfill a mission. And the mission is to give you folks the information you need to equip you as citizens and not just as consumers of news.
If I could just quickly add, you know, I've looked at BBC, I've looked at non-American sources, I've looked at Haaretz,
yep.
and I've looked at Al Jazeera. And actually, they're pretty high. These sources are actually pretty high quality. They're not like in total conflict, but you see the framing. You see, you know, news literacy is an important part of what we all need to do as citizens. You know, again, I just could not agree more. Just look at a variety of things. You know, try to, but and I don't. I never say like trust something because it's been around since 1851. I don't think that flies in the digital era anymore. But I would say for any source of news you're considering consuming, click on the about page. Who owns this? Is it some hedge fund? Is it some billion? You know, is it? Well, I mean, who owns this? Who works there? What are their qualifications? Do they publish corrections? To the New York Times' credit, when they make mistakes, they acknowledge them. Not every news source does that. The credible ones do.
I would say all of this is true, and all of this is not only true, but right. I mean, like, truly, fundamentally, you know, those news organizations, you know, Roger Ailes, who was the CEO and then chairman of Fox News until 2016, you know, used to boast on the rare occasions that I talked to him, we've never had a correction, you know, and look at the New York Times, they have corrections. Now, first off, totally untrue, but he didn't care about that. Secondly, not something that shows honor on them. They make mistakes. You know, the Washington Post, New York Times, AP, NPR, we correct them, and that is a sign of your integrity. But, you know, like, I think the hedge fund-owned newspapers are actually work very hard to publish what they get right. You know, the reporters who do stuff for Gannett, USA Today, they're owned essentially by investors, but they really work hard to get this stuff right. But, you know, like, it's hard to do, and they have fewer and fewer people to do it. The sad thing is, what we're asking of you is to do a lot more work at a time that Americans' attention spans, because of changes in digital media and social media, have become shorter and shorter and shorter. So we're putting more on you at a time when you have less willingness and patience to do it. And that's not great for the citizenship that, you know, Suzanne is looking to help enhance and pursue. I want to make sure other questions get, there's some here in front, one here, and one in back, I guess, after.
Hi, I was wondering if any of you had any thoughts on the role of government-funded news agencies. I'm from Canada, where we have the CBC. In the UK, they have the BBC, Australia, the ABC. And on one hand, I feel like I've grown up thinking that these were very trusted sources, but on the opposite end, in other countries, you might edge towards more government, say, propaganda, which is quite, you know, on the polar opposite. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I got thoughts, but I'm interested in Professor Mettler's thoughts first.
Well, you know, it is a case in the United States that here, you know, we're talking about how crucial to democracy the media is, and yet, you know, government doesn't run it, and it has to, in order to pay the people in the newsroom, it's got to be, you've got to make some money, right? And so that is a crucial characteristic of our media, because, and particularly once we've had like a large number of types of media by the proliferation of sources by the late 20th century and early 21st century, you know, if it's, If you're not attracting viewership and listeners and readers, et cetera, you're gonna die. And so I think that that's, you know, probably the biggest kind of bias that's driving the things I'm critical of about what kinds of stories do get covered and which don't get covered, and is, you know, is problematic.
Let me just briefly wade in, because NPR is part of a constellation of public broadcasting, that does receive funding from federal government. We actually receive about $1 million a year. Most years, our budget is, you know, in excess of, I think, $300 million. So it's not a ton of money for us. For our local stations, on average, it works out to about 10%
of their budgets, and we get a little bit of money. We get about 30% of our funds from them, so you could argue we get another 3% indirectly of our funding. For some stations, it's as much as 50%, and those can be rural stations, some stations on Native American reservations, inner-city stations, you know, that serve people of color and who have not always been well served by public broadcasting. So for some stations, that funding is actually pretty crucial. You know, the affiliation, though, is tough. There was a big scandal over stuff that one of our commentators, Juan Williams, said on Fox News because he had a contract there, said in 2010, and it became, he said it in October 2010, and House Republicans, led by John Boehner, rode that into the House of Representatives. It wasn't the only issue. There was a backlash against Obama's Tea Party, but that was sort of their last push across the finish line. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of executives at NPR, other places, who say, would it be more useful if we didn't get any money from the federal government? You know, God knows, we'd love the funding the BBC gets from their licensing. You know, it's something like £180 a year for each TV set or something like that. But there are costs. You know, Elon Musk decided one day to designate us, and then a couple others, as State-run media, which is the designation they give to RT, you know, which is Russian media.
Or Xinhua in China.
Right, which are basically, literally propaganda outlets. Yeah. And then after his biographer said that's not really fair, he changed it to state-affiliated media or state-funded media, which there's some truth to, but it's a designation they give to compromised media. We have statutory independence. We are not a federal agency. We are not-for-profit corporation, wholly private. But it's not without some complications. You've seen some funding efforts in New Jersey, where I now live. You've seen in the state of California, I think Governor Newsom signed a bill that basically seeded money through the University of California's Berkeley's journalism program. So there are a couple dozen journalists that go out, and they're private ventures that do this nationally, to sort of enhance newsrooms. But so you have governments, are they funding hedge fund owned?
No, California and New Jersey, they're basically trying to seed money to local nonprofit newsrooms like ours, that and there's an intermediary of basically expert panels that are choosing which organizations to fund. It's a hotly debated question, actually. There are some journalists who think absolutely no role for government funding. There's also others, and I would probably count myself in this camp, who are kind of open to it if there's a lot of safeguards. But it's a very complex issue. I don't think it would work. I mean, you know, remember, the U.S. does have a state broadcaster of a kind, but by its charter, we're talking about Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, but by its mission and charter and by federal law, they can only broadcast, and their focus is outside the United States.
And let me point out,
and that dates to the Cold War.
I spent much of 2020, from May 2020 through January 2021, when I wasn't reporting on presidential politics, reporting on the concerted effort of the Trump administration to compromise the Voice of America.
Right.
I mean, it was concerted. You had federal judges calling it unconstitutional. You had inspector general reports that I obtained saying that certain things that happened were illegal. I mean, this was as concerted and as perfect a distillation of the Trump belief that media was corrupt, so therefore we should be able to turn it to our interests, and also a deprofessionalization of the government, civil servants, and nonpartisan staff. It's a fascinating case study, and I recommend, if you really wish to be put to sleep at night, to go back and read some of my stories. But it was really good stuff. There's a question back there as well. Okay, I'm sorry, we haven't done this side. Go ahead, Henry. It's a ringer. He's a student journalist, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, my son. Shout out to my sonnies over there. So I wanted to ask you guys about the two questions about the future of the industry. My first being, how do you feel about the sort of current growth of nonprofit newsrooms sort of as a response to the sort of death of local journalism in a lot of rural areas, which are now not receiving news coverage, and some are now receiving news coverage as a result of nonprofit newsrooms? And my second question is, what do you think the role of so, like, earlier, I mean, we talked about, like, the gatekeeping journalism. How do you guys feel about the role of, I guess, sort of citizen journalists? And you're seeing this a lot in Gaza right now, where you have people who aren't really tied to any, large organizations sort of covering what's going on in the region. What role do you think citizen journalists, I guess, play in the overall larger news landscape? And should organizations be sort of employing individuals of that nature?
Let's go to that second question, because I think you and I are going to be representatives of nonprofit news, and I think they play an important role. Yeah. And I'm guessing the professor won't, if that's all right with you. But let's focus on that second question.
I think it's a great question. I think, you know, again, as I kind of alluded to earlier, I don't think it's our place to say who's a journalist and who's not. And increasingly, I think about who is engaged in journalistic activity. And that could include local volunteers. It could include citizen journalists. It could include, I mean, the Pulitzer Prize Board, which I'm deeply honored to sit on, awarded a special citation to Darnella Frazier, who was doing the video, who recorded George Floyd's death, in recognition that she was engaging in journalistic activity, though she's not a professional journalist. I thought that was very interesting. There's a nonprofit that's been getting a lot of attention called Documenters. They're based out of Detroit, Detroit originally. But what they're doing is going into underserved communities and training ordinary citizens to take notes, attend public meetings, digest what happens at those meetings, since there are now, sadly, so many communities where there aren't reporters to cover the water board, the school board, the county council. And Documented has gotten some real recognition. I think it's a very promising model. I don't know how scalable it is, but I absolutely think it's worth considering. Look, I don't think it's journalists' role to be up on high and be like, well, this is news and this isn't, you know. This is ultimately more an art than a science. And I think that if there are, you know, I have just one story from early in my career. I was running the New York Times' local news blog when that plane landed safely on the Hudson River. It was kind of a miracle. It was a good news story. Everyone celebrated the pilot. But that was one of the first stories where, like, people who survived near death on that plane, immediately once they got off, started taking photos and tweeting. And, like, it was really interesting, right? Like, they were essentially engaging in journalism of a kind. I mean, I was a little bit surprised that, having nearly died, the first impulse would be to tweet. But everyone would do that now, but this was back in, like, 2009. But you know, that's a kind of journalistic activity, too. So I'm not really about policing boundaries. I think that, you know, as long as people are supplying accurate information, you know, they are engaging in journalism even if they're not professionally trained as journalists.
Although there's been some interesting complications where you've seen news organizations cut ties with folks who have been freelancers. Yeah. It's been very hard to get people from outside Gaza into Gaza safely, journalists to cover that. They've relied on Palestinian journalists, some of whom are excellent, and some of whom also have strong feelings about the Israeli control of the area and what they've done to Palestinians there.
Yeah.
And so there can be tensions there. I want to ask one question. I want to make sure to take one or two more questions, which I think about one more question, I think, is what I'm hearing. But I wanted to ask one question that I hadn't heard addressed. Do either of you think news organizations should do something specific they can think of, that either of you can think of, to reach Trump voters, you know, probably a good quarter to, you know, more of the nation, sort of have core Trump voters, who scorn what we think of as the legacy or legitimate news media? Like, you know, this is a significant portion of the American population. Is there a way in which some of the things we've discussed hold them at bay and don't draw them into a larger, broader conversation?
There's actually been some research about how news media fail to reach highly conservative audiences. You know, we actually heard from some of these scholars, and part of its framing, as I said earlier, there were certain kinds of it was interesting, we also did some internal research. You know, our slogan used to be like, nonprofit, nonpartisan, news in the public interest. And basically our research found that no one cared that we're a nonprofit, and that when it came to nonpartisan, people were like, well, I'll be the judge of that. And so we actually, I mean, we're still nonprofit and nonpartisan, but we actually changed the banner or whatever to say, you know, independent news that Texans trust, something like that. So it's not just marketing, though. I actually think that we have to do a better job of listening. I think that people's reasons for voting for Trump, for example, are much more heterogeneous and complex and contradictory than is often reflected in the press. You know, people, as Suzanne said, they don't go in and do a very rational analysis of, I'm going to go issue by issue and see where, you know, which, they're not downloading the policy doc. I mean, I said this in 2016. Hillary Clinton had a position on everything, but people were not going to the issues section and downloading each and every platform. They were making their decisions based on a lot of other variables, unfortunately, to some extent. But I think that, like, we just need to be much more careful at listening. I think framing's really important. And I also think that, like, you know, events like this one, I mean, we find that public events are a really great way of building trust. And so I think that that's what can happen, too. I also just want to say one thing. In some of the most conservative parts of Texas, I've actually had some of the most productive and interesting conversations, because these are places that are so conservative, there's really no Democrats around. But there are also places that are news deserts or that are underserved, neglected by government. And when we went into those communities to talk about broadband, economic development, the shortage of medical specialties, real issues, the cost of housing, flight, the diminution of farming, people were very open. And even though we're mainstream news and we're based in Austin, but when we showed that we took those issues seriously and wanted to engage with them, we got a lot of positive feedback. You know, the way to cover Trump voters is not by starting, is not to start by asking, why did you vote for Trump? That's like literally the dumbest question. I mean, you know, you should start by asking people about what's going on in their life. What are their concerns? Now, you may find that they're getting all their information from Fox and that explains why they vote for Trump, but it's often not that simple. As Suzanne said, it's partly because, you know, I grew up in a community where no one votes Democratic, and so I inherited that affiliation. There's a lot of reasons why people vote the way they do. We shouldn't assume that someone's voting behavior is the entirety of their story.
Suzanne, let me give you the last word on that. You know, is there something that media organizations should be doing in that very regard? And if so, what would you encourage them to do?
Well, I applaud everything that Sewell said, but the answer I'm going to give is sort of complementary to that. I really appreciated that you were highlighting that, you know, there are news deserts now in rural areas. So the work I'm currently doing, the book I'm working on, is about the rural-urban divide in the United States and really trying to understand why rural areas across the country, which used to move together in presidential elections with urban areas, have moved increasingly in the Republican direction in every region of the country since the late 1990s. And in the interviews that I'm doing, I ask, you know, the kinds of questions that you were talking about and get really interesting answers about what's been happening in those places. But rural places, you know, with the demise of local newspapers, lots of rural places now have no newspapers at all. And so, you know, then people that easily become swept up in these national issues when there's no attention being given to the local issues at all. And so, you know, when you're not hearing about what's going on in your local school board, you might get all worked up about critical race theory when it might have very little to do with the quality of education in your school. And so I think, you know, to the extent there are foundations trying to do rebuilding, I would really try to direct money to rural areas. Yep. And with journalism that both informs people about what local government is doing, but also tells their story, you know. And I'll give a shout out to my mother, who was a newspaper editor in the rural area where I grew up. And she had an award-winning newspaper here in New York State. And they both, you know, covered the town boards, the school boards, but also wrote beautiful feature stories about local life, people in that area.
Local obituaries.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't stint on the joy, as one of our news executives used to say at NPR. Suzanne Mettler, revealing her cards at the very end as something of a journalist in her DNA. Suzanne Mettler, Sewell Chan, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you on behalf of Cornell and Cornell's Art School. And thank you so much for coming.